with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Sea Boat Sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Sea Boat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local Farmers Market at the Square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. Located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square Mall, downtown Urbana. Information is available at 384-2444.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Let me just mention very quickly that tomorrow morning in the first hour of the program, we'll be having a conversation that is both a little bit about cultural history and also about architectural history. And our guest for the program will be Alistair Gordon, who is the author of a book titled Naked Airport, and despite the impression that that title might give you, what it is a history of the airport from its very earliest beginnings to what it is now. And I think that should be an interesting conversation. So that'll be in hour number one. Hour two, we will be talking with Ambassador John McDonald. He is co-founder of the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy, based in Arlington, Virginia, and we'll be talking about the need to focus on drinking water and sanitation. And he is here in Champaign, Urbana, to take part in a conference looking at water issues globally, in a global sense. And in fact, the guest that we have with us here for this hour is also here for this same conference. It's going on here on the U of I campus and is jointly sponsored by the various campus centers that are concerned with looking at various regions around the world, that is, African studies, East Asian studies, Latin American studies, South Asian, Middle Eastern studies, and so forth. So that'll be tomorrow. I'm sure that we'll get to perhaps some of the same issues in this second hour of Focus 580 this morning as we talk about environmental issues in India. That's what we'll be concentrating on. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always give you the opportunity to call in if you have comments or questions. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will indeed be talking some about environmental issues in India, particularly about water. I think that there are many people who believe that perhaps the most pressing environmental issue in India, most pressing environmental issue and perhaps most pressing threat to public health in both urban and rural areas is access to clean drinking water and sanitation facilities. And this morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Amita Bhaviskar. She is a sociologist who's particularly interested in environmental sociology, in the sociology of development, in social movements and human rights issues. And she has written about these issues. She's authored a book on environment and development entitled In the Belly of the River, Tribal Conflicts Over Development in the Narmada Valley. She's also written articles on tribal politics, on women in the environment, and also on human rights in India. She is at the moment a visiting professor at Stanford University, and before that was a lecturer for a number of years in the sociology department at the University of Delhi. She was educated here in the United States. She received her PhD from Cornell in developmental sociology, and is here, as I mentioned, to take part in this conference looking at water issues around the world. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, welcome to the program.
Thank
you.
Have you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I suppose that some people might say, well, why, if you want to talk about environmental issues, why concentrate on India? And I think that it is true, or at least some people have said, that when you take a look at India and you consider the diversity of both culture and geography, look at issues like the spread between wealth and poverty, look at its size, look at issues having to do with development, that India is a microcosm. You can use it as a case study to study just about anything that is an issue anyplace else, just because of its size and complexity.
That's true. And I think if one looks at all the issues you mentioned, overpopulation, the problem of poverty, development, etc., At root, they're all to do with resources. And natural resources are among the most important resources we can talk about in that context. So land, water, forests remain absolutely essential to any effort that India as a country makes in order to develop. And given that these resources are generally the source of a great deal of conflict between groups who have rights to them, between other groups who want to take them and use them for something else, we see a lot of social movements around these resources. And in a way, then environmental movements end up addressing not only the cause of the environment, but they also end up asking questions about democracy, about development, about how the nation should develop, and where the place of poor people in the nation might be.
I think something else that I think is really quite interesting and striking, and again, it may say that India is unique or it may not, is the idea that the kind of environmental problems that you see in India are connected both to growing affluence and also to poverty. Both of those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that that is an explanation that holds true for, has held true for about 200 years, in the sense that the poverty of India initially directly came about as a result of its colonial history, when a lot of resources from India were taken away and they helped fuel the industrial development of Great Britain, which ruled India for more than 200 years. So as an independent country, India was had to deal with, had to reckon with these kinds of great economic inequalities. The fact that the British had left behind a national elite that was responsible for planning the country and for being its political leadership, but a political leadership that, you know, has, I think, failed to do justice to the aspirations of a lot of poor people. And that situation has really worsened in the last, I'd say, about 15 years, when from the 1990s onwards, India has been forced to follow a path of economic liberalization, which is much the same as has been happening in countries around the world, in mm-hmm. Latin America, in the rest of Asia, etc. And what that path of liberalization has done is that it's moved resources from the government, a government that had at least some commitment to social justice, into the hands of private corporations. And with that, we see disparities on the rise, rich people getting richer, and poor people having to fight even harder for the resources that they earlier could stake some claim to.
Hmm. Has that, for example, has that been the case specifically when we're talking about water?
Indeed. I would say that the very first assault on local people's access to water happened on a major scale, happened immediately after independence, when India began to build large dams, large irrigation projects. And ostensibly, these projects were for national development. They were for the public good, in the sense that they provided water for irrigation so India could become self-sufficient in food production. And they provided water to populations in cities. Though what happened along the way was that, in fact, over time we came to realize that this moved water away from small local communities into the hands of people, or rather into the mouths of people who were already fairly well off. And that sort of a tendency has accelerated from the 1990s onwards, because water is getting privatized. For instance, one of the biggest social movements right now in India is against Coca-Cola and Pepsi coming in and getting the right to just sort of siphon off groundwater that used to be earlier available to villagers, both for drinking as well as for, you know, irrigating their crops. And so villagers don't have drinking water, but if they want and if they can afford it, they can go out and buy a bottle of Coke. So that's the kind of inequality that people are trying to struggle against. And I think it's become much worse now with privatization.
Hmm. Well, and I'm certain that struggles like this happen in many different places around the world, where there's this fundamental question of who owns the resource, or is it fair to say anyone owns the resource? Something that, on the one hand, you would say has to be managed for the common good, because everyone needs it. And in a sense, everyone should have a claim on it. And yet, at the same time, there are competing claims, and both among groups of individuals and also people who would come along and have a commercial use for the water. I mean, how in India does this discussion go around this issue of the most basic issue of to whom does the water belong?
Right. Well, I think water is that way much more complicated than, say, land, in the sense that with land, the issue of property rights is cleaner in a way. It's neater. Either land belongs to some private company or a private individual, or it belongs to the government. And in certain cases, land is held in common, for instance, by village communities, and they use it for common uses like grazing or, as fallow lands, etc. Now, that's not so in the case of water, because often access to water is a sort of a free-for-all. You might own a tiny piece of land, but if you can sink a really deep well, you can end up, siphoning off water from an underground aquifer that's going to then affect your neighbors and people for many, many miles away. So you could, just by having access to one particular well and a big pump, you can end up, infringing on other people's rights. So water rights are not quite as clear-cut as, say, land rights are. And even though one may then talk about a moral right to drinking water, which is, a basic human need, often that right is very, very hard to actually give to people, because it means taking water away from someone else and making it available to others in a situation where it's not clear, who ends up having to pay for this. And often the idea of common good then becomes this disguise for a way of taking water away from some people and putting it in the hands of others. So, for instance, large dams have been built in the name of the common good, and they've been built, along the claim that they're going to be actually delivering drinking water to people who didn't have drinking water before. But the sad and hard truth of large dams is that they end up taking water to cities where there are factories that demand water, where there are rich consumers who want that extra water to wash their car, or they end up going to rich farmers who are going to grow more water-intensive crops, like sugarcane, because that's where the money is. So what gets done in the name of the public good and the common interest often ends up then actually hurting the interests of those who are most vulnerable and who are the most disadvantaged people among the public.
Mm. Are there organized efforts, individuals or organizations that are working to try to at least represent the interests of the people who have the most difficult time making their voice heard and their interests heard?
It's happening more and more, because I think the battles are getting just that much more acute. And there are all sorts of efforts across the board at different scales. So we see, for instance, small village communities getting together to build check dams that will try and harvest water, rainwater. Because unlike the U.S., the major uncertainty around water in India is the ecological fact of the monsoons, that a large part of India is dependent on rainwater. And the rains can be uncertain. One year you might get a good monsoon rain, the other year you might not. Mm. And so the country actually then fluctuates every year from drought to floods to, a normal monsoon to, a good rain, etc. Unlike, say, in the U.S., where the water situation tends, I think, to be more stable in the sense that, you know that if there is snow, there's going to be, water available from snow melt, etc. So given that there's that inherent uncertainty, it's harder for groups to mobilize. But we see that, there's groups putting pressure on the government to try and come up with schemes that will support people who are trying to do something to preserve water locally. There's pressure on the government to come up with laws which will regulate water access, which will prevent people from being able to, just drink up all the groundwater because they happen to have the deepest well. Prevent people from digging new wells when they know that the groundwater has sunk, lower and lower every year. So there are those sorts of social movements. There's a lot of interest within the government as well to do something about it, even though there are very powerful interests that would like to, in fact, intensify water use because, water is really something that's essential for industrial production, for manufacturing, increasingly in urban areas to take away urban sewage, and for sanitation purposes, etc. There is also the fact, which is, I think, probably unique to India, which is that rivers happen to be sacred. And that fact that sacred rivers should not be polluted has also been something that people have been trying to highlight as a way of getting the public involved in trying to keep rivers clean, install pollution control plants, and all sorts of other techniques of trying to keep rivers, which were once clean, make them clean once again.
Maybe I should introduce again our guest, Amita Bhaviskar. She's a sociologist who's particularly interested in environmental issues. She at the moment is a visiting professor at Stanford University, also was for a number of years a lecturer in sociology at University of Delhi in India. She is visiting the campus here to take part in a conference looking at global water issues. In fact, she is the keynote speaker for this conference and will be talking this evening at 7:30. The talk is at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. I believe this also is an event in the MillerCom series, and all of these talks, they're always open to the public and free. And, of course, anyone who is interested should feel welcome to stop by and hear what she has to say. And questions, of course, on this program are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now, here in the United States, I think surveys, if you go around and you ask people, do you think that environmental issues are important, that a lot of people will say yes. Now, whether or not that translates into public policies, that's something else. But at least in people's consciousness, if you ask them, they'll say, well, yes, we obviously think the environment is important and environmental issues and the quality of the air and the water and so forth is important. If you do that same sort of thing in India, is that something that is high in people's consciousness, just the idea that, yes, our environment is important and human activity does have an impact and that we really ought to be thinking about what we do and what that means for the environment and not just for us today, but, of course, for children, grandchildren, and so forth.
Right. Well, the environment is thought of in those ways as important in and of itself, important as a set of, you know, ecological processes where the rights of other species matter, where the rights of future human generations also matter. But the environment for India's growing middle class also matters as a part of its larger lifestyle. People want to live gracious lives, and that means having a beautiful environment. If you live in the city, it means having green areas, clean air, etc. And that view more and more is coming into conflict with another view of the environment, which is the environment as a source of basic livelihoods. And what we find is that when people talk about water or land or trees, far more people depend on these resources as the basic resources to live with, cultivating land, collecting forest produce, fishing rivers, etc. And the quest for cleaning up the environment often means that there's a monopoly of more well-to-do, more affluent social groups who want to take the environment out of the hands of those who use it for basic subsistence. In the case of Delhi, for instance, there's been this very large campaign for a clean and green city that's resulted in the removal of slums and the closure of factories on the grounds that the factories are polluting water. Now, that's thrown at least 2 or 3 million workers out of their jobs with no sight of, you know, compensation or some alternative coming along at all. And yet it's sort of, you know, everybody praises it as, oh, you know, we're closer to having a clean river. But the point is that there are people who, you know, cannot even afford food or clean water to drink because, you know, they have no resources. They don't have the jobs. They don't have the incomes or the salaries to be able to pay for living in a desirable environment. And so there is a darker side to thinking about the environment as something that needs to be clean and beautiful, part of a gracious lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very interesting, that the way in which this becomes, first of all, it becomes an urban issue, and it also becomes an issue of class conflict between people who are more wealthy and people who are less, and that something that would seem on the face of it to be so praiseworthy as having a clean environment, having green spaces, dealing with industrial pollution and so forth. On the face of it, all those things sound pretty good. But then when you get down to it and you look at how exactly it's being done, then you have to ask these questions about, you know, balancing interests and who benefits the most and who pays the most.
I think the reason why that sort of a balance doesn't emerge in the Indian case is that A lot of people who are hurt by this kind of middle-class environmentalism really don't have a voice in the decision-making process. What we find are upper-middle-class groups of environmentalists who go to the court and they will ask the Supreme Court, using public interest litigation as a weapon, to work to clean up the environment. And the Supreme Court usually obliges because the judges come from the same sort of background that the environmentalists come from. What's happening is that a consideration of all viewpoints, of all the people who are affected by a situation like this, doesn't happen, partly because workers don't have a voice in the process of decision-making. The court doesn't listen to them. Somehow, they just seem to be this invisible class that's an underclass that, is supposed to just, go away. In fact, because I've been working on this issue of urban displacement because of middle-class environmentalism, I asked the Labour Commissioner of Delhi, who's the sort of top official in charge of looking after the welfare of workers, about the impact of factory closures because of this, attempt to clean up the river. And, workers, all these workers have lost their jobs. What do you think about that? So he said that, he used this very, very interesting metaphor. He says water finds its own way. They will leave this. They came into the city to work. They'll leave the city and they'll find work somewhere else. So it's really this idea of workers as these, the ebb and flow of these footloose nomads. They'll come and they'll go, and it doesn't really matter to the rest of us. That I found was, the most, it was this blatant sort of class perspective on the issue, which. Yeah, completely negated the fact that workers also have rights.
So what does happen to these people?
Well, in Delhi, unfortunately, many of them just leave. They settle on the outskirts of the city. They try to get by as they can, often in illegal jobs, in small factories which come up anyway against the rules. And they somehow manage to survive. And that means that they're always vulnerable. They're always criminalized because what they're doing is illegal and the factory shouldn't exist because the courts ordered that they be shut down. And so there's this flourishing illegal economy of desperate people who are trying to just get by. Unfortunately, that's what's going on most of the time. And there are a few movements which are trying to organize workers, but it's very hard to organize workers who aren't sure about their next day meals. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to get them to protest when that one day of protest will mean that they're not going to earn any money for that one day.
Whatever it is that these people are producing, is this being produced, the goods that are being produced, are they produced for domestic consumption or are these things that are produced for export?
Well, both, because one of the main things that's happened with the privatization of the economy is also increasing subcontracting as firms find it cheaper to just, push all their costs elsewhere. Larger firms are able to push their subcontract out their, accessories and small component manufacture into the what's called the informal sector. And it is cheaper because the informal sector doesn't pay workers what they should get in terms of minimum wages. It gives them no pension, no security, no insurance in terms of accidents, etc. And so it's a way of, increasing production that goes into not just the national economy, but also export. So you'd be surprised how many sort of American brands get produced in tiny slums on the outskirts of Delhi.
Well, that is the question. That's sort of why I asked the question, because I think that certainly there are at least some Americans who try to think about if they're buying something and it's manufactured or parts of it are manufactured outside of the United States, they're interested in who made it and what conditions for those people are like. And that's really specifically why I asked the question, whether indeed we are talking about something that could find its way in some form into the United States as something that would be on the shelves here and that people would go out and buy.
Right. And that would be an important way of campaigning from both ends to try mm-hmm. and put pressure on these sorts of firms. But the immediate impact of this could well be negative in the sense that it could mean that instead of cleaning up their act, literally, these factories end up just folding because the logic on which they work is really low-cost work. So if, they're forced to improve the ways in which they work, they're going to fold up because many of these are very small, undercapitalized firms. So I think it's a much more complex picture than one tends to imagine. And it's very hard to say, you know, this sort of a campaign is going to have a direct effect in terms of getting worker better rights and in terms of being better for the environment. Because I think right now that's, so you know, being presented as a trade-off. And we need to really think of other sorts of alternate ways of arranging work that still results in firms being viable, workers getting their fair share, and then the environment also not being negatively affected.
Well, I guess that would be my next question, whether indeed that is possible to satisfy all of those concerns and to, for the people who work in factories like that, to provide them with a living wage and at the same time address environmental concerns and at the same time address concerns about the health and environment of urban life. Can one actually satisfy all of those concerns?
Well, I wish I could point to some, you know, perfect case and say, well, you see, those guys are doing it. I don't think that's I can come up with any one success story as such. But I see a lot of pressure in certain sorts of industries from the government, from NGOs, from environmental groups, as well as workers' groups, to come up with new kinds of solutions. Because everyone at some level realizes that the problem is, you know, way too hard to handle alone, and that there need to be new kinds of efforts. So trade unions, which earlier would never ever talk about environmental issues because they saw themselves as primarily defending workers' rights in the sense of fighting for better wages, etc., now realize that, in fact, they do need to engage with the environmental question because whether they like it or not, it's there to stay. And workers have to, in some ways, they have to change their strategies to address it. So interestingly, in some industrial units, workers are themselves coming up with very, very context-specific solutions. So they're pointing out particular industrial processes and how they might be made cleaner. And in some ways, doing that makes it better for workers themselves because the occupational hazard that they deal with is also then reduced. So I think there are those sorts of small, very localized, context-specific solutions that people are coming up with. And if those are encouraged by government policy as well as by environmentalists seeing that, you know, this actually means that there is no trade-off between environment and workers' rights, it might actually result in a growing number of small solutions that make sense locally. So, and that could be the kind of model to go with.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. In Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm sorry I wasn't listening from the very beginning. I was listening to the end of the analysis of Bush's press conference, and he was late in getting there. So I apologize if I repeating anything. Could you put it in a broader context? I mean, one reason why I guess unions might be more sensitized is because it's a matter of having a similar enemy in that or antagonist in that some of the large corporations that they might be working for now are also some of the players in privatization. And I'm wondering whether you could also say anything about this as the broader idea of privatization of other utilities, we'll call them, I guess, in that it seems that water is so dramatic because, you know, one can only live so long without water, and it's the stuff of life, et cetera, but power and other utilities and things like that are also set for privatization in various areas. There have been scandals next door in Pakistan about privatization of power, and I was just curious if you could broaden it. We have the example in Bolivia where Bechtel is now suing the Bolivian, one of the most impoverished countries in the world, for breach of contract because they the people rose up and threw off the privatization of water there, which I understand actually included disallowing people from gathering rainwater off their roofs, which is really astonishing to think that they would try to ask a government to do that kind of thing. So I'm going on. I guess I'll hang around since there don't seem to be any other callers at this point to see if I can make another point, but not necessarily.
Well, You're quite right that the privatization of water is happening together with the privatization of other utilities like power as well as public transport. Most of it is being fiercely resisted in India by trade unions, which of course have a strong interest in seeing that their own workers who work for these utilities don't get fired, as many of them are threatened with. The problem, though, is that there's actually a very little public support for government employees in public sector utilities, mainly because they have, I think, systematically managed to antagonize everyone by being, sort of slow to respond, by being corrupt, by being inefficient, etc. I'm not saying that that therefore justifies turning over these resources to the private sector, not at all. But when the privatization move was presented to people as a move towards greater efficiency, I think a lot of people were ready to at least entertain that possibility, because the government-owned utilities were just seen in such negative terms. It is, though, very clear now that despite the transformation of these utilities from public sector to the private sector, there's been very little change in terms of the delivery of power or water, etc. In fact, what we have seen is the rise of rates. So electricity costs more now, water costs more. And a lot of people who were earlier able to get these things, even though they were poor, because the government would subsidize these facilities and make them available to the working class, now that's no longer available, because for the private sector, if you can't pay, then you're just left out, you're just excluded from the system. So there's again this rethinking going on just now to, in a way, step back from the extensive privatization that was contemplated to move towards some sort of mix of perhaps a certain degree of private control, but mixed with government supervision, with government monitoring and regulation. And I think with the new government in India that came in the month of April, we see a stronger commitment to that kind of public scrutiny, as well as greater government control over resources which earlier were just scheduled to be privatized. That, I think, is the situation with utilities. And I think, it's in some ways, privatization has also made a number of the trade unions rethink their own role. And that sort of takes me back to your earlier question about the unions and, their willingness to come together with environmentalists and work against corporations. I should actually clarify that most of India's workers, in fact, are not unionized. The great majority, some people say up to 70% or 80%, happen to be workers in the informal sector, which means that they don't work in large firms. They're not unionized. If they try to unionize in any way, they're just likely to lose their jobs and be replaced by someone else. That makes it very, very hard for them to actually think beyond their most immediate needs of, just having a job, even though it might not be a secure job, and just getting by on a day-to-day basis. So it's a really challenging situation. And I think, therefore, the role of trade unions in coming together with environmentalists to try and challenge privatization, etc., even though they've begun to think about these things, it really needs to be something that then takes on, that can somehow include this large, large body of workers in the informal sector. I think there's a sign, the one hopeful sign is that now the government's talking about increasing guarantee of employment. And that first step towards giving some form of social security to workers may well mean that then they are able to then have the kind of social network and economic network that would then allow them to mobilize politically as well and formally demand their rights.
Isn't it true, though, that the jobs in what would one might call the modernization sector, the utilities and that sort of thing, are predominantly, have been in the past, more unionized and more subject to regulation and government control than any of the informal. I mean, I think that's...
That's absolutely right, yes. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, government, all the utilities that were government-owned had employees who were permanent employees of the government, and then, you know, who had all the benefits that should go with that sort of work. But much before privatization started in, the government had anyway begun subcontracting out a lot of its own tasks and relying more and more on private contractors. So rather than, for instance, replace workers who were retiring and fill up vacant posts, the government would simply close off those lines and then shift those tasks onto contractual laborers who then weren't entitled to the same kinds of wages as well as the benefits that permanent employees were. So the government was anyway trying to slowly get rid of its large workforce.
Well, that's the neoliberal Washington consensus, and that's what's eroding our wage scale base. It seems to me that I'm happy to hear that India seems to be going in the other direction, at least a little bit, in the sense that by guaranteeing advantages to the informal workers, they're actually more informal workers. They're actually, instead of bringing the more regulated and unionized employees down, it's bringing people up, which is contrary to the race to the bottom kind of model that we're.
It's a very unusual
move. Thank you very much. I'll let them know.
Okay. Just as you just mentioned a little bit ago, there was there were elections this spring, and there was change of government. The Congress Party, which had previously for a long, long time been India's ruling party, was returned to power after having been out for, I don't know, a decade, and maybe, and having been replaced by the BJP. And during that campaign, I think the BJP leadership, the BJP, was going around making the pitch that they should stay in power. And arguing that their policies had been very successful, their economic policies had been successful, and India was booming, was doing very well. And apparently, a large part of the reason for the victory, but this sort of surprise victory by Congress Party, was that a lot of people felt that they had been left out, that there may have been a boom going on, but that their lives weren't better. I'm wondering whether in that campaign there was much discussion about environmental issues, and in all of this conversation about growing prosperity and more people wanting to be included, sharing in the benefits of that prosperity, you know, where does environment come in that conversation? And are people likely to put economic growth first and environment second, or lower down on the list?
Well, you're quite right that the BJP fought the elections on the basis of a campaign that they called India Shining, and the idea was India was, you know, leading in the world, growing, and everybody was happy with that. But this, they also banked on something they call the feel good factor, that people were satisfied with the way in which the economy was booming. Well, as it turned out, they were, you know, completely wrong, because they were voted resoundingly out of power. And the Congress came back, and interestingly, the communist parties, which had earlier been slowly going off into a decline, suddenly bounced back into the political scene and are now major partners from the outside of the Congress government. And they're making the Congress really stick to its social mandate that it had promised in its election manifesto, part of which was the Employment Guarantee Act that I'd mentioned earlier. In this debate around the election about India shining, India's economic growth, the environment didn't figure in precisely those terms as a set of environmental issues. But what did come out was the huge disparity between the BJP's sort of glossy advertisements of smiling people and the reality of a lot of the country reeling from drought. And in central India and southern India, the repeated news which, you know, kept coming up, which was the fact of farmers committing suicide. And these were farmers from the dryland part of India who were killing themselves because their crops had failed. In many cases, they were growing cotton, and cotton which had become heavily pest infested. And these people were in debt. They had taken loans to plant the cotton. They had taken loans to buy pesticides, which in many cases didn't work. It was discovered that a lot of the seeds that they were using were spurious seeds, because the government system of you know, producing high-quality agricultural seeds had, in fact, been slowly dismantled, and people were now buying seeds from private seed companies. So the environment question did come up, but it came up in the form of this issue of agriculture, high capital agriculture, which is very, very risky, and in many cases, which, you know, proved to be a failure. So that farmers who were, you know, up to their neck in debt basically drowned and then killed themselves because they couldn't see any way out. Mm-hmm. So that's the way in which the environment, in the sense of the health of the agriculture sector, came to be a really important political concern, both in terms of government support slowly, you know, sort of fading, as well as environmental crises around water, around seeds that didn't work, around pesticides that failed, around pests that infestations that became really serious.
Let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Champaign. It's our line number two. Hello.
Hello, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to throw one thought out here. So, I mean, about the problems that are there in India. So part of the solution to India's water problems and possibly some of the larger environmental problems, that solution could lie in the hands of the consumers in the more developed countries, specifically G8 and U.S. Essentially, what I'm saying is that the reduction of strident consumerism and paying a fair price for the goods they need, that is going to improve the wages for the workers in underdeveloped countries. And that effectively is going to give them, you know, more. I mean, essentially, they can put the money into cleaning up the environment, and then they don't have to fire the people. They don't have to close the factories. Then they can keep on running. What that means is, of course, I mean, the G8 countries, they have to either reduce their standard of living, or I don't know. I mean, that is just a thought. Just want to throw it out.
You know, I agree with you, and I agree that, you know, we need to build far more direct connections between, you know, people who are consumers and whose affluent lifestyles are in a way responsible for creating poverty, impoverishment around the world, as well as environmental devastation. But, you know, in the case of India, I would argue that if we're looking for northern consumers, we don't have to look abroad. Because India has such a large and growing middle class. We're talking about something like 300 to 400 million people, 30 or 40% of India's population. That is powerful. That's consuming the country's resources right there. And I think the situation would be different in a smaller country, which is much more dependent on external consumers of its products. Because in India, the consumers are right there in mainly in, you know, metropolitan centers, rich people in, you know, big landowners in rural areas, etc. So I think the Indian middle class, as much as rich consumers in the G8 countries, like you said, need to take responsibility. And of course, they're not going to do that on their own because, you know, who likes to give something up? But I think that's where the social movements which try to put pressure on middle class consumers really need to make a dent, because people won't give anything up unless they're forced to do so. Right. And I think, I mean, therefore, regulating groundwater use, for instance, mm-hmm. Would really be an important step towards getting people to realize that they cannot use water as much as they would like, because it's a direct impact on somebody else's access to the little water for, you know, basic needs.
But, I mean, okay, I worked in India for you know, several years, and I used to work in Bombay. And I used to travel from, and I was in a, you know, reasonably well-paying job, mm-hmm. but my problems were, I mean, just incredible. And I would have been considered as a upper middle class, but I mean, disposable income, or even, I mean, the just for travel, or even for water, apartments, anything, it was very, very, you know, difficult life in a place like Bombay. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I don't think the middle-class people, the 200-300 million middle-class people who are there in India, I don't think their footprint is as much as it is for a, you know, you take a, even a, you know, a middle class or lower middle class person in places like US or UK or Japan.
I agree with you completely. But I think that what does happen, you know, you're describing populations in cities like Bombay and Delhi who end up, because even they don't have enough water, in cities like Bangalore and Chennai, they might end up having to purchase water, etc. But by and large, what happens is that, and we see this happening with the government all the time, that these middle-class groups are in a position to put pressure on the government to demand water. So, for instance, Delhi has a large number of schemes which involve, you know, making, building dams in the Himalayan region and bringing water all the way from there just to meet the requirements of consumers in Delhi. The other thing about middle-class consumers is that they're much more able to devise private solutions to the problem of water scarcity. So they will buy tankers of water, they will install, you know, if water quality is a problem, they will install water filters in their homes, etc. So in a way, what they're doing is opting out of a collective effort to try and improve access to water, to clean water for everyone. And generally, the government is more likely to meet their demands. And the chances, therefore, the likelihood that poor people who need water will be able to somehow get it is that much dimmer, because middle class people have privileged access to the government, and also they have privileged access to the market and to privatized solutions such as buying drinking water.
Yeah, that is only true with probably Delhi is a special case in all the metropolitan areas in India, because it is the capital, you know, region. And then they got a lot of the middle class there. They got a lot more political clout than, let us say, people in Bombay or people in Hyderabad, where, I mean, they are away from center. And the middle class there is, again, I mean, the one thing is that, I mean, I was born in a village and grew up in a village. And then I went to, you know, Hyderabad, then Bombay, and I lived in New York. I lived in San Francisco area as well. And the rural areas in U.S. as well. So my, I mean, impression of the, you know, Indian scene is that basically Delhi is a special case. There the middle class has a lot more, you know, clout, and a lot of people listen to them. So, but on the other hand, that is not true with the middle class in other metropolitan areas. Their standard of living is far lower than everybody else.
Right, but they're still much more, I mean, it's all relative, of course, but they're still more able to command water to come to them at the expense of, say, poor farmers in northern Tamil Nadu or, say, Andhra Pradesh, etc. Now, I agree with you that if we look at resource use inequalities, then certainly northern Europe, Western Europe are much more privileged, and in some ways, you know, they have been able to develop the way they have because they're able to command resources from the rest of the world. But I wouldn't completely let Indian middle-class consumers off the hook either.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank
you.
Thank you. Let's see if we can get one more. We'll go to a caller in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, perhaps your guest can project ahead a bit, perhaps only 50 years, and the present problems are not going to go away around the world, including the U.S. and every other Eastern, Western, or Asian nation where the paradigm is universal. And the projection towards who has and who has not, and in what numbers, and how this will affect the 6 billion people who are exist on this earth now. 50 years ahead, they're projecting more people, which will exacerbate the problem. And my own observation on these earth-shaking matters are the lifeboat theory. I mean, every day there are certain people being thrown out of the lifeboat that we call civilized society. And as that becomes worse, I see only the devastation of those people who cannot compete, who could never compete. And I know it is a dark picture, but I'm afraid it's the reality. And perhaps your guest could project ahead on those ideas. And thank you very much.
All right.
I agree. It is a desperate scenario, and it looks like it's going to get worse. But I do believe that every crisis is also an opportunity to try and devise some other way of dealing with the situation. I think there are tough questions being asked about why we are in this predicament now, what brought this problem and made it so acute. And I see people then trying to do the best they can, not just to manage, but actually to augment the amount of water they have available. I'm thinking here of things like water harvesting, where people collect rainwater and try and store as much of it as they can to last them through the dry season. And there is a tremendous potential right there of trying to meet water shortages that happen in particular seasons like the drought season. That's not going to be enough unless there is some way also of regulating how we use this water. And I think there is increasing pressure now, there has to be, to try and come up with more equitable ways of using water, as well as ways of trying to just move water from, luxury uses, recreational uses, to more basic necessities. Because at the end of the day, that requirement that water meet certain basic human needs in terms of water for drinking, for cooking, etc., as well as for growing crops, I mean, that's still going to be the essential core of the politics around water. And I would not like to be pessimistic, because I see, and I'm constantly inspired by the social movements I see around me, that it is a gloomy situation, but people are doing their best. And I think sometimes they're doing their best with a great deal of creativity that I think needs to be both supported as well as celebrated.
Well, we will have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. For people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, I do want to mention again that our guest, Amita Bhavaskar, will be giving a talk tonight on the U of I campus. This is a talk in the MillerCom series. It's also a keynote address for a conference that's going on called Troubled Waters in a Globalizing World. It's sponsored jointly by a number of units on the campus to talk about various issues involving water going on here over the next couple of days. She'll be speaking tonight at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor at 7:30, and anyone who is interested in stopping by should feel welcome. Amita Bhavaskar is currently a visiting professor at Stanford University, and before that was a lecturer for a number of years in sociology at University of Delhi in India. She is a sociologist by her academic training, particularly interested in things like environmental sociology and social movements. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting Stephen Sondheim's Assassins, considered one of the most controversial musicals ever written. Performances run from Wednesday, November 3rd through Sunday, November 12th. For more information, call 351-2528. The program is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the program is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the lives of Americans during the Roaring Twenties and the Great Depression. Our guest will be historian David Kivig. He is the author of Daily Life in the United States, 1920 to 1940. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. December wheat, 301.5, that up 1.25.